Tales the gods gave to the kings on Turiat, the night of Bet Iman. I found them years after my mother died, and they led me to Sahid Alaz, led me to the Asurim. She took a drink and wiped her mouth with the back of her hand. Glancing through the gutted window on her left, she wondered if the moonless host really would arrive tonight, as Beryl had promised. She had no great desire to delay her return to Sharakai, but she had to admit that the chance to speak to Ishak, her grandfather, was strong, and taking a bit of time to gather some support, any support, would be welcome. After pressing the petals, my mother would store them in a necklace. She slipped the necklace over her head. It was silver, a bit tarnished but not terribly so, and shaped like a candle's flame with an intricate desert design etched onto its surface. This very one. She opened the locket and breathed in the scent of the Adhikara blooms. There are no petals left, but you can still smell them. She held it to the twin slits of Karim's narrow, desiccated nostrils. His eyes closed. He breathed deeply, like one might a bouquet of flowers after having been lost for years in the desert. When he opened his eyes once more, they seemed to have gained a bit of clarity.
My mother carved!
His wheezing, rattling whisper reminded Chader of a sandstorm. The shriek of it, the rattle of the sand.
She carved wood, but later stone. Trinkets to sell in the bazaar, or far out in the desert during our pilgrimages.
What did she like to carve?
Bah!
Karim swallowed, tried again.
Birds! Amberlocks! Finches! Blazing blues, herons wading in the Hadda, like your sword, and other animals. Word spread and she was commissioned by those from Golden Hill. She was asked to create a bronze sculpture of Bashir for a fountain in the merchant's quarter near Hanging Gardens.
I know the one. Chader said.
She made it.
Chader could hear the pride in his voice.
And it was glorious. Perfect. Bashir claimed it had not captured his likeness well enough and refused to pay. 2 months of work gone. And debts stacked high after borrowing against what she was promised by the House of Kings. And still they put the statue up, removing her sign from the base, so that no one would know it was her work.
Karim's eyes were intense, angry.
When trouble began to brew with the desert tribes, there were rumors that our tribe would bear the brunt of the battle. My mother harbored a naive belief that our family might be saved, that we might ask one small favor of Bashir to protect our family.
He went silent. They both knew the folly of such a hope. Does she yet live?
No. But you met her before she died. She was killed by Sahid Alaz when he was nearly driven mad by Mesut.
Dear gods, Chader remembered. An Asir, who had been a woman once, had taken Chader into the strange cavern beneath Sharakai, where the glowing stone had been. Sahid Alaz had been there and in his grief and near madness from Mesut's torture, had killed that Asir, beaten her head in against the glowing stone, then come for Chader and nearly killed her, too. What was her name?
Her name was Virad. And she was kind until the last.
She was kind, Chader echoed, Taking one of Karim's emaciated hands in hers, she kissed his fingers as a tear rolled down Karim's cheek.
Oh, Karim, I owe her my life.
He swallowed hard, shook his head.
Fighting the will of the gods is no easy thing.
He meant the urge to return to the blooming fields, to join the others hidden beneath the Adhikara.
I will find a way to free you. It felt right the moment she had said it, like it was something she had been avoiding for years, though in truth she'd learned the true nature of the Asurum only a year ago. I will find a way to free you all.
Karim was shaking his head.
I warn you. Through us, the kings can reach you.
She already knew it was so. Karim was right. She had to be careful. But the Asurum had to be her priority. If Sharakai were to be freed, the king's greatest weapon must be taken from them. Sensing movement, she turned and saw the white knife of a sail cutting along the horizon. Standing, she saw a blue pennant twisting in the breeze atop the skiff's lone mast. It looked like a snake freshly pierced by a spear. The scene was so striking and her relief so palpable, it felt as if this moment had been preordained, a vision in one of Celaya's hanging glass prisms.
Don't worry, Karim. Help has come.
Chapter 8. The twin moons were bright scythes in a star-filled sky as Emre waited beneath an archway, the crumbling entrance to an old boneyard. He watched the way ahead for the signal Maseed said would come when the moons were high, but he was spending nearly as much time watching the ranks of crumbling pillars behind him for the telltale signs of the dead rising from their graves. He would have waited elsewhere, but the truth was that most in Sharakai were as leery of the dead rising from their graves as he was, and these days it paid for a scarab of the moonless host to be in places where other people were not. Things had only grown worse in the days following Galieu's betrayal. At least a dozen scarabs had been found murdered. More had been taken. The kings had been finding their safe houses with such frightening frequency that Emre feared there were more traitors in their midst. Some believed Hamzakir's honeyed words, believed that he would lead them where Ishak had not been able to. Was the Knight of Endless Swords not proof? Many thought so, ignoring all the work Ishak had done to build a coalition among dozens of warring factions. A surprising number had already thrown their lot in with Hamzakir, but those pockets still loyal to the old guard were vulnerable to spying, treachery and assassination. A hulking wagon with bars across its windows trundled past. A hunched, angry-looking man sat atop it, whipping the horses. It looked like a slaver's wagon heading for the blocks, and Emre feared the driver was his contact. For a moment he was sure the wagon would stop and the driver would bark at Emre to jump in the back, but thankfully the man never turned. The wagon was soon gone, and Emre was back to glancing at the boneyard for unexpected company. Nearly an hour passed while the moons marched westward. Occasionally, small groups of men would file into the oud parlour up the street, labourers from the quarry most like. A few stumbled out, often singing in slurred verses, an old woman yelling from the building across the street whenever they did. Finally, as a pair of cats began hissing on a rooftop, a man with a cap sitting at a jaunty angle came strutting down the street. He paused as a cluster of dirty gutter wrens flocked past. He warded them away from his purse with a hand on his knife and then headed toward Emre. He was Emre's age, a touch over 20 summers and handsome. His clothes weren't what one would call finery. He was no East End lord, but they were rich for this part of the city. Still, he wasn't the usual sword Osman, who owned and ran the most popular of Sharakai's fighting pits, would hire to shade information across the city. He was about to tell the young man so, give him a ribbing and see what he was about, when he recognized him. Suddenly all the words Emre had at the ready flew up and away like a flock of blazing blues.
By the stars above! If it isn't Tariq Asarava!
He said it in the tone of a mother who hadn't seen her son in years. Tariq's face screwed up in annoyance as he glanced to the darkened windows along the street.
Announce it to the whole fucking city, Emre!
He kept it up, running his hands over Tariq's clothes as if he couldn't help himself.
It's only I haven't seen you in ages, and now you show up at my doorstep!
Tariq slapped his hands away.
Has Osman demoted you?
Emre went on.
Sent you back to shading?
No, I'm not bloody back to shading. I've got my own crew. I'm practically running the pits now. But your employers are paying a pretty pile of ral for this. So he thought it best I come.
He paused.
Wipe that ruddy look off your face. This is serious.
Emre sniffed, pretended to wipe a tear from his eyes.
My baby, all grown up.
When Tariq shoved him back into the boneyard, Emre smiled all the more.
Never could take a joke.
And you never knew when it was time to stand up and act like a man.
Emre shrugged off Tariq's annoyance. It did his heart good to be with someone, anyone from his days before the Moonless Host. He wished they could sit a while, talk of things other than kings and killings and the cruel realities of life in the city, especially since he was about to leave Sharakai, perhaps for good. But he guessed it wasn't meant to be. Tariq may have felt the same. He knew Emre was about to leave as well, but if he did, he said nothing, and the awkward look on his face was soon gone.
You've got the name of the ship, then?
Emre asked. In answer, Tariq handed over a folded piece of papyrus with a wax seal on one side. It looked like a rearing Malasani lion. The note would contain the name and location of the ship that would smuggle many of the remaining scarabs and Sharakai to the desert. Emre was desperate to read it, but Masid was the one who would break the seal. It was a desperate step they were taking, but these were desperate times. Those trying to hide were dying by the dozens, while those who tried to escape aboard ships had been found by the king's warships or by the silver spears before the ships set sail. It didn't seem to matter if they posed as crewmen, paid for a cabin or stowed away below decks. Even skiffs were being hunted down with cruel efficiency, leading to more and more hangings at the foot of Turiat.
When? Dawn. But be there an hour before. No later. And you'll not be allowed on.
As he spoke, Tariq reached up and tapped his cheek with two fingers. It was a signal shademen used to indicate that they were being watched, and to act normal. They'd used it years ago, primarily when the silver spears were near but hadn't caught on to whatever it was they were up to. A drop, a pickup, whatever Osman had asked them to do.
Very well,
Emre replied. He turned and nodded toward the oud parlor.
You want to get a drink for old times?
He'd scanned the street, marking the alleys, trying to spot anyone who might be watching, but if anyone was there, it'd take better eyes than his to spot them. Tariq paused, unsure how to voice his thoughts, but then he shook his head.
You know,
he said, his voice so low Emre could barely hear it,
Osman's always looking for good men. Might be you could still find a life here in Sharakai.
He was suggesting that Emre abandon the Moonless Host and remain in Sharakai. Emre had heard it often enough from friends from his old life and dismissed it out of hand.
But to hear Tariq say it, only moments after a signal that they were being watched.
What would I do?
Emre asked, just as softly.
A man like you would need to lie low for a while. It's dangerous these days, especially around the harbors. But we'd find a place for you.
As a fucking shade man,
Emre thought. Work he'd done when he was 15. Those had been simpler times, but ultimately empty. He had been reborn when he had joined hands with the Moonless Host, and he wasn't ready to give it up, certainly not to become an errand boy for Osman.
Take care of yourself, Tariq.
Tariq seemed disappointed, more than Emre would have guessed, but then he nodded.
You as well, Emre.
And then he was gone, back to some rich place near the pits.
Hopefully somewhere safe in the arms of a woman he loves, Emre thought as he strolled past the oud parlour.
He recognised his thoughts for the foolishness they were. There was no such thing as a safe place in Sharakai. Not anymore. Not for the host, nor Osman and his crew. Even the innocent men and women who walked the streets each day were as likely to get blooded as anyone else. Emre wandered the West End, making sure he wasn't being followed. Only when he was sure it was safe did he head for the back of a weaver's shop, stepping into the small yard from the back alley. A pair of women holding bows crouched on the roof, watching, waiting. Frail Lamai's tall form lifted from behind a pile of crates.
You got it, Emre?
I got it.
Even in the darkness, Emre could see Frail Lamai's wide grin.
We'll be leaving soon, right?
That's right. Just need to talk to Masid about it.
Right.
He balled his fists, released them.
Right. Best you do that, Emre. It's important. Real important.
I know, Lem.
Inside, 20 looms were spread across a mostly open space. Several men and women slept on the floor along one side, but on the other, near the door to an office, was Hamid's stocky figure. He waved Emre over. When Emre reached the small office, he was surprised to find a man he recognized, though not from his dealings with the host. The thin man was sitting at the desk in voluminous purple robes and a beaten packol, the color of the desert sunrise atop his head. This was Adzin, the old soothsayer. Scattered over the desktop before him were more than a dozen scarabs. They crawled, constantly moving, skittering toward the edges of the desk. Whenever one came close, Adzin would reach over, pluck it up, and set it back in the center of the desk. Masid stood by the desk. Darius was there as well, plus several other men and women, elders of the Moonless Host. They all watched Adzin transfixed. When Emre came closer to the table, Masid looked his way.
Emre!
He said with a note of relief. Gods, he looked terrible. Sunken eyes, stooped posture, and on his face a look of worry and weariness that seemed wrong on a man who projected confidence at all times, and whose reserves of energy had always seemed bottomless.
We thought you might have been taken.
No idle chit-chat,
Adzin said, picking up another scarab and setting it practically on top of another.
Now is the time for haste.
When Masid glanced Ardzin's way, it was clear that, for now at least, worry was winning the war against weariness.
Come!
He waved to Emre.
Tell Adzin your tale.
Tariq came to the boneyard.
From the beginning,
Adzin snapped.
In detail.
Masid nodded.
Start from your walk to the oud parlour.
Emre launched into the events of the evening, from his walk north through the city to the people who went in and out of the oud parlour,
to his uneventful watch from the boneyard's archway.
Was there a sign above the wood parlor?
Ardson asked, his arms moving like jugglers keeping all the scarabs in play. They had become more animated, moving more with speed, but Ardson kept pace with ease.
Yes, Emre answered. The device upon it. A rearing goat.
With those words, Ardson picked up one of the beetles, but instead of setting it down in some other place atop the desk, he popped it into his mouth and began to chew it like it was a honey-coated almond from the spice market.
Gods, the crunching sounds!
Emre couldn't help but grimace. He had eaten a scarab once.
On a dare.
Chader had told him she'd eat one if he did. When he said no, she'd raised her stakes to 2 as long as he ate his first. He still refused, but when she upped her bid to 3 with Hamid and Tariq both watching, he'd finally agreed rather than lose face. He'd managed to get the squirming thing down, but only after retching a half dozen times. He had thought Chader would stand and run, make it a big joke, but she hadn't. Her face screwed up as she summoned her courage. She'd picked all 3 up and shoved them in her mouth. Her eyes had watered, but she had chewed, as if she were on a mission to save the world. Afterward, she'd opened her mouth after to prove she'd eaten every last bit. Emre was already queasy, and the sight had pushed his stomach over the edge. He'd thrown up right there on the dusty street to the laughter of all his friends, none louder than Chader's. Emre stared in horror as Ardson continued to chew, until Masid made a hurrying motion with his hands. Emre told them about the sober men marching in, the drunks stumbling out.
The songs being sung?
Ardson asked when he mentioned the music coming from the oud parlour. Emre had to think.
The Trollop and the Tinker. The Beggar King of Ashtankat.
Another scarab popped into Ardson's mouth like a savoury treat.
The sorts of graves?
He asked when Emre came to the boneyard.
Old, tightly packed, crumbling pillars.
Another beetle, the crunching sound making Emre's teeth itch. And so it went, Emre talking, Ardson downing more of the beetles until only 3 were left. Ardson inspected them very carefully, moving closer until they were mere inches from his face.
How long did the 2 of you speak?
At this, Emre paused. If he told the truth, Masid might wonder why they'd chatted so long, whereas a lie might doom the entire undertaking.
A quarter turn, perhaps?
Masid turned to Emre, his gaze becoming more intent, but he remained silent.
So long?
Ardson pressed.
We grew up together, Emre said.
Ardson shrugged, then picked up both remaining scarabs, 1 in each hand.
Lastly, the appointed time you were told to meet the ship. An hour before sunrise.
The scarabs crawled over Adson's fingers, and he flipped his hands back and forth like a Moraean teacup dancer.
And so, we arrive at your 2 choices, he said to Masid. Do you take the offered ship? Or do you steal a ship of your own?
Masid watched Ardson and the scarabs intently.
That's why we've come to you!
He held his hands out to Masid.
That is for you to choose. But know this. Lives will be lost either way. And on one of the paths, yours is lost.
Masid blinked. He licked his lips. Emre had never seen him look so haggard.
If I die, will more live?
Ardson pulled his gaze up from the scarabs to stare deeply into Masid's eyes.
If I delve too deeply, Masid Ishagava, it will foul everything. I've given you all I can give.
Masid closed his eyes, took a deep breath. As he released it, he opened his eyes, plucked the scarab from Ardzin's right hand, and stuffed it into his mouth. As he chewed and swallowed, Ardzin studied the one remaining scarab.
The decision is made, he said. Take the ship that was offered.
Masid looked to the rest of those gathered.
We'll rest for a time, then head to the harbor. Hamid and Emre, come with me.
The three of them took the stairs up to the roof. The two archers Emre had spotted earlier bowed their heads to Masid, but at a wave from him they cleared the roof. Hamid began speaking as soon as they were gone.
I still think we should.
But at Masid's raised hand, Hamid's words trailed off and his expression turned to one of sullen silence.
Do you know why we chose Ardzin for this?
Masid asked Hamid.
Because he can see the future,
came Hamid's sharp reply.
There is that,
Masid shrugged, the weariness in him showing even in that one small gesture.
But Ardzin cannot know all. His divinations have been known to fail, or only proved accurate using the narrowest of interpretations. Then why use him at all?
Hamid pressed.
Because we are nearly done here. With Hamzakir's spies and the King of Whispers hounding us, we won't last long. There's no shame in the retreat, my young falcons, as long as the fight is kept alive. We must make sure of it, the three of us, now. What can we do?
He motioned downward, indicating the room below.
We've spoken now. Despite all our preparations, the King of Whispers may have heard us, or the Jade-Eyed King may have seen it, perhaps written of it before he died. We cannot know, but we must get as many safely out of Sharakai as we can. So I ask that you two stage an attack on a ship as planned. Take the ship if you can, retreat on skiffs if not, then meet us in the desert.
He didn't say where the host were gathering. He'd shown them the name 3 days ago, then burned the paper. Faramush, a large oasis beyond the caravanserai of Tiazet, in the far eastern corner of the Shangazi. It was where most of the higher-ranking members of the host were headed, Masid among them. Others were headed elsewhere, returning to life among the desert tribes where they could act as spies or garner support. At the least, they'd help stem the flow of blood that Hamzakir was exacting from the moonless host. It was hard to remember what a tremendous victory they'd achieved on the night of endless swords, especially knowing how few had remained loyal to Masid and his father Ishak. But the greater the victory, the more desperate the enemy. They had always known a terrible storm would descend. Now that it had come, they had to weather it as best they could.
Take another man each, Masid told them,
and before they could protest,
it's all we can afford.
Then he left them to talk and to plan.
Two others, Emre thought.
Gods, there were few enough in Sharakai left, and he knew this was only a feint to throw the kings off their scent. But this was suicide.
Let's go,
Hamid said sharply, his voice at least still full of fire. They went down to ground level and chose Frail Lamai and Darius to join them. Darius seemed appropriately afraid when they told him. Frail Lamai, however, looked as though it were nothing more than stealing a pile of copper ket from a lone blind beggar.
Which ship?
He asked, stretching his neck as if he were about to fight.
Doesn't much matter, Hamid replied,
and off they went, heading for the southern harbour by way of the Corona, the street that hugged the outskirts of the city.
Which one, though?
Lemai called from behind them, confused.
I'll show you when we get there,
Emre replied.
Strange how Tariq was acting tonight, he said to Hamid, who jogged by his side. Offered me a place with Osman if I stayed.
Hamid glanced his way with a self-satisfied grin.
For as much hot air as came out that jackass mouth of his, he was always soft.
Emre shrugged. Tariq had always felt like a brother to him, more so than Hamid. Tariq had gotten Emre out of plenty of scrapes, little matter that he had gotten him into half of them. It made Tariq's offer all the more curious. Frail Lamai caught up to them, looking like he had something important to say.
I know Tariq.
They ignored him, hoping he wouldn't launch into a litany of the times he had seen him. It was a thing Frail Lamai did often, as if it showed how good his memory was.
Gets around, Tariq does.
Hamid and Darius remained silent, their pace steady, but Emre began to slow, and when he stopped, Frail Lamai did too.
What did you say?
He asked Lamai.
Tariq! He gets around.
Darius and Hamid had started walking back. Hamid glowered at both of them.
This is no time for your nonsense.
Emre raised a hand, focusing squarely on Frail Lamai.
What are you talking about, Lem? He came by Ardson's ship when Darius and I were watching it.
All eyes turned to Darius.
That true?
Hamid said. Darius shook his head.
No. Sure,
Lamai countered.
When you were off, taking a piss.
A stunned silence fell over their group. Darius looked aghast.
Nalame's teats, Lamai. Why didn't you say something?
Emre and Hamid shared a look.
We've got to find him, Emre said. We have orders,
Hamid shot back.
Not anymore, we don't.
Emre was running toward the well where Osman's pits were situated.
I smell a rat, Hamid. Best we find it before it leads the kings right to us. God damn you, Emre!
Hamid rasped.
Come back!
But Emre kept running, and the others soon followed. Chapter 9. Ramad walked along a busy street in the shallows with Amaryllis by his side. Chichio led the way, fixing anyone who came near with that dead-eye stare of his, daring them to challenge him. Vrago, his long hair pulled into a ponytail, brought up the rear, his peacock strut on full display. Amaryllis tipped her head to an alley on their right.
Right there.
Without slowing, Ramad shot a glance down the alley. A dozen paces up, three toughs squatted in the dirt, playing bones. One whipped the dice against the wall, then grinned as he took half the coins from the pile of copper near his feet. The other two hung their heads and groaned.
They're the ones who stopped you,
Ramad asked. The day before, Amaryllis, Chichio, and Vrago had come on Ramad's orders to get Tiron. But they had been stopped by the toughs who ran the drug den. Amaryllis nodded.
Those three and one more. He's probably inside, tending the addicts.
A year ago, he would have walked right up to them and demanded to know where Tiron was, but this business with King Kiral had made him nervous. The last thing he and Meriem needed were rumors that Chimir was starting trouble in the streets.
There is another entrance.
Amaryllis pointed up the street.
Around the back.
They continued to the choked intersection, the crowd squeezing past an open area where tourists and fools were tossing money at a con artist, sliding chipped ivory bowls over the dusty street. Ramad and the others pushed past, then continued until they had reached a small courtyard selling incense and scarves and vests. They got dirty looks from the vendor and her husband as they pushed through the stall and headed for a gap between the buildings. A boy, wearing a dusty woolen cap, was leaning against the wall, whittling a stick into the form of a snake. The vendor's son, perhaps, but he was blocking their way.
"Best move on," Ramad said.
Wide-eyed, the boy made way and Ramad, Amaryllis, Chichio and Vrago squeezed themselves into an alley barely wide enough for them to sidle along. They reached a window with boards nailed haphazardly across it. Ramad took out his stout knife and pried the lower boards off. Ducking low, he angled himself in, knife at the ready as his eyes adjusted to the darkness. The smell in the room was thick. A haze of lotus smoke hung below the ceiling like a rare winter fog passing over the city. All about the ramshackle room, dozens of men and women, a few children as well, lay sprawled across the dirt floor in varying states of delirious repose. Some leaned against walls or corners. Others sat cross-legged or with one leg stretched out, heads lolling as they rode the dark waves of the lotus. Most simply lay on the floor, eyelids heavy as they stared at the ceiling. Their limbs occasionally twitched. A few paces from Ramad, close to a broken set of stairs leading up, sat a massive shisha, with 8 tubes snaking out from it. 6 were occupied. A woman sat near it, a beaten tin cup sitting forgotten between her legs. Her eyes were the most alert of those lying about the room. Even so, when she turned to Ramad, it took several long seconds before her gaze drifted down to his knife. The whites of her eyes shone as she snatched up her tin cup and began to rise. She stopped, however, when Ramad put a hand on her shoulder. Words of alarm died on her lips as Ramad tapped the blade of his knife against his lips and made a long, shushing sound. The woman dragged her gaze to Amaryllis, then to Chichio, who had folded himself practically in two to slip through the window. After a pointed stare toward the front door where, just outside, the three toughs were still playing at bones, she lowered herself back down. The four of them moved quickly after that, searching for Tehran in the choked rooms along the ground floor. Then Ramad pointed upstairs and motioned for Amaryllis to follow. Chichio and Vrago remained at the foot of the stairs, fighting knives drawn. The stairs groaned as Amaryllis and Ramad headed up. Near the top, another tough with a shaved head met them.
"Hey!" he shouted, reaching for the long knife at his side. "Hey!"
Ramad charged, grabbed his sword arm and punched him hard in the throat. The tough coughed and tried to snatch Ramad's shirt, but he had lost his leverage. Ramad shoved him hard against the wall, one forearm pressed against his throat while holding the knife to the man's stubbly cheek. The tip came to rest along his twitching eyelid. Amaryllis checked the four adjoining rooms for Tehran.
"He's not here!"
"Was this one here yesterday?"
Ramad asked her in Khmeri, indicating the tuff he was holding.
"I wasn't,"
the man began.
"I asked the lady."
"He wasn't here,"
Amaryllis replied.
"You're sure?"
"Yes, I'm sure,"
she snapped, annoyed.
"Down,"
Ramad said in Sharakan. The young tuff looked petrified, but he didn't move a muscle. Ramad hooked his ankle and threw him to the floor. He fell with a thud, grunting, but remained silent. Amaryllis gagged him, then tied his hands and ankles together behind his back
and bowed down close to his ear.
Quiet now. Wouldn't want you to lose your tongue.
They stole down the stairs and headed for the front door, collecting Chichio and Vrago along the way. The four of them filed into the alleyway, where the sounds of the shallows, muted in that boarded-up cave, lifted suddenly around them. Ramad walked to the nearest of the men playing bones and sent a crushing punch across his face. Sweet Alu's grace, it felt good. The man looked more surprised than angry as he tried to catch his balance. His arms windmilled, eyes blinked rapidly, and he thumped hard against the dirt. Vrago, smiling, held the tip of his sword to the man's throat to keep him where he was. The other two remained on their knees when Chichio motioned them down using his sword. Ramad addressed the shirtless one with a long row of earrings on each ear and tattoos along his temples and forehead.
What's your name?
Pony.
For a moment the words died on Ramad's lips.
Why Pony?
He asked. Chichio laughed and looked to Vrago.
Pony, like a little boy, huh?
Vrago's smile widened, revealing a perfect set of teeth. Pony's eyes moved quickly between Ramad and Chichio and Vrago. He was trying not to let his fear show, but he was young and it was plain to see. When his gaze landed on Amaryllis, his brow knitted for a moment. Recognition coming and going in the span of a heartbeat.
Yesterday, Pony. The beautiful woman standing behind me came to find my brother, but you and your little lambs refused to let her take him. Why?
The man licked his lips and gathered some small amount of courage.
None of your business. Of all the answers you could have chosen, Ramad told him calmly, that was likely the worst.
Amaryllis was already striding forward, her fists raised. When Pony realized she wasn't going to stop, he raised his fists as well. He managed to make it to his feet. He even managed a swing at her, but it was clumsy and oafish. Amaryllis ducked the blow and sent a left hook to his kidney. Pony grunted and tried to land an uppercut, but Amaryllis juked around it. Her next punch was a vicious right hook to his opposite kidney. It struck so hard, so perfectly, that a cringe-induced slap rose above the din of the nearby crowds. Pain contorted his features as he fell to his knees. For long moments, he simply groaned while his body curled around the punch. Ramad crouched until the two of them were eye to eye.
She's in a good mood today, Pony. Do you know how I can tell?
Glancing up at Amaryllis, the man shook his head.
Because she let you off easy. But I wouldn't test her again if I were you. Now why don't you tell me why you refuse to let her take Tiron?
He coughed, but otherwise remained silent.
Very well.
Ramad stood, and Amaryllis strode forward again. Pony's hands were waving in the air before him.
It was the widow!
Ramad put a hand on Amaryllis's arm.
Come again?
The widow told us to keep him here, make sure no one took him.
And who is the widow?
Pony stared at him, as if he were an idiot.
She owns the place, and a dozen more just like it.
Ramad and Amaryllis shared a look. She nodded to Ramad's unspoken request, more than ready to find out more. Ramad lifted the man up by one arm.
You're coming with us. It's time the widow and I have a chat.
Just past high sun, Ramad stood with the others beneath a bridge that spanned the Hadaz, dry bed. He was studying a three-story mansion that the man called Pony had identified as the widow's home. Some passers-by had spotted them, but none had taken much note, especially when Chichio had shown them the keen edge of his knife.
"She's there now?" Ramad asked.
Pony nodded from the safety of the deeper shadows.
"She drinks wine on the top floor near midday."
Unlike most of the nearby buildings, the mansion was made of cut red stone and was well kept. A ruby hemmed in by a fistful of common stones.
"Even today?"
It was Salandi, a day of rest in the desert. Pony shuffled his feet, kicking up dust from the dry riverbed.
"Most like."
He was nervous. He'd hardly looked at the widow's mansion. Ramad knew little about her, but Pony had talked on the way there, impressing upon them that she was a woman who repaid betrayal with blood. Ramad nodded to Amaryllis, who used her knife to cut his bonds.
"Run back to your little friends," she said,
then kicked him away. He stumbled and fell, then got up and sprinted along the riverbed, keeping his head low. With him gone, Ramad, Amaryllis, Chichio, and Vrago climbed the bank and made for the entrance as fast as they could. They wanted to give the widow as little time as possible to prepare. The front door was closed, but there were windows open, a breeze blowing soft white curtains inward. Ramad was just about to start taking the stairs when the front door opened, and out stepped three guards, two women shamshirs, already drawn, and a bull of a man holding a studded club easily in one hand. Behind them, Ramad saw a boy he recognized, the one with the woolen cap who had been whittling the wooden snake.
"I should have bloody known," Ramad thought, feeling foolish.
He should have waited, watched the place more carefully, but he'd been too worried about Tiran to delay.
"I'm here to see the widow,"
Ramad said, coming to a halt at the foot of the stairs.
"You can meet her,"
the barrel of a man said in perfect Chimeran.
"But only you. And I'll have your weapons before you go in."
Ramad stopped and took the man in anew. He had the copper skin of the desert, but a bit of the heavy brow that indicated Chimeran blood.
"What's going on?"
Slinging the club over one shoulder, he held out his hand.
"You'll have to ask the lady."
Ramad considered, then pulled his sword and knife and handed them over.
"Take him!"
The man called over his shoulder as he accepted the weapons. The boy nodded, then waited as Ramad stepped inside the house. The building was moderately impressive, especially in comparison to its neighbors, but on the inside, mighty Alu. It looked as expensive as any of the homes in the Hanging Gardens in Charakai's rich East End. Bronze statues on pedestals, paintings on the walls, frescoes on the ceilings and in grottos spaced throughout the blocky architecture. They reached a central stairwell and took it up two stories. From there, the boy led him through a set of open doors onto a patio where a woman sat wearing a dowdy dress and a black shawl over her head. She was old, Ramad realized. Very old. With wrinkled skin and sunken cheeks that lent her a hound-like appearance. Her eyes were sharp, though, and her mouth downturned, as if she were angry and not concerned that it be known. She waved toward the opposite chair. Ramad took it, a wicker chair, a thing found commonly in Chimer, though rarely in the desert.
"I must admit you have me at a disadvantage."
He'd spoken in Sharakan, but the widow responded in perfect Chimeran.
"Seems to me I have both your balls in one hand. The question is whether I ought to squeeze."
Her eyes moved to the thick flame-shaped bottle between them.
"Pour us some, won't you?"
Ramad did, pouring what looked to be Chimeri brandy into two heavy glasses. As he did, he noticed the maker's mark on the bottom. This particular brandy from Chimeri's southern coast was highly sought after here in Sharakai, so it wasn't so strange to see it. But when added with everything else, it did feel odd. Ramad had been brewing toward a battle with some local drug lord, but now it felt as if he were sharing cordials with a fellow noble along the shores of the Austral Sea. All that was missing was the cool breeze and the briny smell.
"Who are you?"
Ramad asked.
"Well, I am the widow."
She motioned to the brandy, then picked up her own glass, which was shaped more like the wooden cups given to Chimeri children than a glass meant for proper drinking. After tasting the apple-sweet liquor, she said,
"The more pertinent question is who you are, and why you're asking after Tiron."
Ramad sat back in the chair and drank. He savored the strong taste, the caramel notes, before speaking again.
"Where is he?" "You didn't answer my question," she said, her words more biting than a moment ago. "I'm a man who cares about Tiron."
She stared into his eyes, measuring him.
"Tiron came to my home of his own free will."
Ramad laughed.
"Is that what you call that rat-infested den? A home?" "The shelter it provides, as you well know, is not of the material sort." "I could argue it doesn't offer shelter of any sort, but that's beside the point. I care about Tiron, no more, no less. He may at first have come of his own free will, but not any longer. I doubt he knows who he is most of the time. I wish to take him home." "He is a paying customer, and he'll be allowed to stay as long as he wishes." "Is it about money, then? If I pay you, you'll give him to me. Who is he to you?" "Who is he to you?" Ramad shot back. "What do you care as long as you get paid?"
He pulled the leather purse from his belt and upended it.
20 rar and 12 silvar. More than enough for a man to smoke of the lotus in a den like yours for weeks on end. More than enough to kill a man," Ramad thought. "Tiron is a special guest." "Of yours?"
The widow stared, her face set in stone.
"If not yours, then whose?" "I would never share such things."
Her chin jutted as she tightened her hold on the brandy glass.
"Now tell me who you are and your purpose with Tiron." "I am Ramad Amansir, Lord of the Arosa, brother by marriage to Queen Meriam Shan Alduan."
The widow stared, her eyes turning uncertain.
"Lord Amansir?"
Her brows pinched in a look of confusion, as if her life depended on solving the puzzle that had just been set before her.
"My Lord Amansir," she finally said, "I'm afraid you'll have to speak to the Queen about Tiron." "Mighty Alu, why?"
But he was already beginning to understand. A moment later, as the widow set her glass down with a thump, his fears were confirmed.
"It was the Queen herself who asked me to keep Tiron."
Chapter 10. The patio outside Davood's apartments was an oddity created when a new wing had been added to King Sukru's palace centuries ago. It was a triangular space surrounded by tall walls on all three sides, which prevented him from seeing any more of the palace than the top of a minaret and one rough shoulder-like projection where Sukru's apartments were situated.
For many nights since his return to Sharakai, Davud had enjoyed sitting on the patio, listening to the palace as it settled down to slumber. The night sky, the chittering insects, the cool breezes had all comforted him, but now they served only to mock, for they marked the end of another day of failures. It was the day before Bet Jair. He was sitting with a glass of the finest rice wine he'd ever tasted, hunched over the patio table while poring over Hamzakia's book of sigils, the one Sukru had embellished. Xander, his personal guard, had thankfully, finally, been given other duties. Davud still saw him from time to time, especially with Anila, but he had given Davud time to work in peace. Leaning back in his chair, Davud released a pent-up breath of frustration that took a much larger swallow of wine than he was accustomed to. The journey to the blooming fields was tomorrow, and he had been trying unsuccessfully to master the sigils King Sukru had added. There was one particular sigil. He'd thought he'd missed something, but now he wasn't so sure. He'd tried it dozens of times, and had yet to feel any sort of spark from it. Hamzakia's sigils had all been flawless and worked for him almost immediately. Sukru's were less so. Perhaps they'd been copied imperfectly, or perhaps the originals, whatever tome or scroll or table they'd been copied from, had been wrong. Still, what could he do but try? Over and over he had attempted to use the combined sigil on the nearby ornamental fig tree, the sigil that used flora as its base, with decay and mastery layered upon it, and felt nothing. Would it be different out in the desert? Were the Adhikara so different from fig trees that the sigil would work there though it had failed miserably here? He doubted it. That Sukru seemed outright vengeful wasn't helping matters, but he resolved to keep trying until he'd run out of time. After piercing the skin of his hand with the blooding ring Sukru had given him, he drew the sigil on his palm while cradling the three related concepts together in his mind. Standing, he stretched his hand out toward the tree, hoping to sense its true nature, as Sukru seemed to want him to do with the Adhikara. As before, he felt a vague sense that the tree existed, that it was bound to him as long as he concentrated on the sigil. But after long minutes of trying, he gave up, knowing he'd get no further this way. Golden Rhea climbed further in the sky, and he wondered how angry Sukru would be with him. Many in the city described him as an opportunist, a vulture among kings, but to Davud, he'd always seemed more like a wounded animal, a man as likely to attack his own as his enemies, perhaps for the mere spite of it. It was then that Davud realized he wasn't alone. There was a small figure in the branches of the tree. The firefinch had returned. As before, it remained oddly still.
"Why do you keep coming back, my little friend?"
He thought of approaching it, but what would be the point? It would only fly away again. Besides, it was a wonderfully cool night. It smelled of early spring, of the hada beginning to swell, and the wine, of which he rarely partook and had probably drunk too much, was doing much to lift his mood. To his amazement, the finch flew down and landed on the mosaic tabletop. Pinched in its beak was a small twig which it set down on the table.
"A present?" Davud asked, amused.
The finch returned to the tree, then came back with another twig which it laid down beside the first, so that they were more or less in line. Davud laughed.
"Two presents!"
By the time the third twig was laid, Davud was starting to understand what the finch was doing, but still couldn't believe it. As he had suspected, the finch returned with a fourth twig, then a fifth and a sixth. It lay each beside the others, taking care to place it just so. Like this, flying into the tree, returning with a twig